Safety, dependability, and power. Chevy Silverado isn't happy unless the work is hard and the day is long. No wonder Silverado is America's number one best-selling retail pickup truck. Go to ChevyDriveChicago.com and put a Silverado in your toolbox.
When did Kirk Douglas decide that maybe it was time to tell a story? Was there something that precipitated all of this?
Well, it was a gradual process. And most of it was had to do with myself. You know, as we discussed earlier, when you're living your whole world in a world of make-believe, it's hard to draw that line between what is make-believe and what is reality. As a matter of fact, Roy, I find this happening with newscasters and things that happen in the world today. Sometimes you don't know whether, is this really make-believe or is it real? And I think that it was important to me to kind of come to grips with myself. I mean, my sons were all grown up. This is not the kind of a book I would have written if my sons were all very young. They're all men now. They could deal with that. And when I wrote The Ragman's Son, and I wrote it in a rough form, my wife never saw it, and then I showed her, because I dedicate the book to my wife. After all, there are a lot of things in there she might object. She might object to. But my wife is a European woman, and I talk quite a bit about my wife and explain who she is, because I think, you know, Roy, you know a lot about a man by the woman he married and vice versa. So I showed my wife the book. I said, look, if you don't like it, I'll never have it published. But she didn't object to it, so I dedicate the book to her.
She did not object to the fact that you, in very frank way, talk about some of the women whose company you have enjoyed over the years?
Well, Roy, if you're going to make the decision to write a book about your life, life deals with love, death, and it deals with sex. You can't exactly eliminate this powerful influence in our life called sex. And I certainly didn't eliminate that in my book, although I don't feel I dwelled on it. If those who are offended by the subject of sex, they can just flip over those pages, because the theme of my book, if I was going to try to put it in that way, I think is more the relationship that I had with my father, an illiterate Russian immigrant, a ragman, who came to this country, who was the strongest man in the town, who was never at home, and I was stuck with six sisters and my mother, versus the relationship that I, as a father, had with my four sons.
Mm.
It's interesting, by the way, you have six sons,
yeah, right.
And I had six sisters.
Oh, in fact, I think one of the reasons I enjoyed the book so much was the relationship that you had with your sons, because even now, mine are all grown up. The youngest is 22 and just graduated from college. And I constantly think, gee, I wish I had spent a little more time when they were maybe 3 or 4 or 5. Everything has worked out. I'm proud of all of them. They've all been successful at what they've done so far. And yet you do think back, and you will always have certain regrets.
You shouldn't have regrets, because I think you do the best you can. And if your kids grow up and function, you're lucky, no matter what you've done.
You mentioned The Ragman. One of the things that surprised me a little bit, it shouldn't, and I'm trying not to be naive, was the amount of anti-Semitism that you had to face, not only as you were growing up, but even in the days of Hollywood, and maybe even today.
Well, Roy, I think anti-Semitism is a fact of life. I think there's a lot of it. It exists all over the world. It's too bad, because I, as a human being, am against any form of prejudice against any minority. And a lot of it stems, when I was a kid, the kids in my street were from, all the parents were immigrants. They came from Poland, Lithuania, Italy, Germany, and all that. And the first beginnings of any kind of racial intolerance, anti-Semitism, starts at the dinner table.
Yep.
It's what the kids hear from their parents. And then that becomes a part of them. And I think that's where it starts, and a lot of people don't. Some people, of course, overcome it. You know, years ago, my son, Peter, was playing tennis on our tennis court in Beverly Hills with a black friend of his. They used to play once a week, and I looked through the window watching them. And one week, they got into the most violent argument. They just yelled at one another. I thought, oh, my God, they're going to come to blows. And you know what pleased me? In that whole violent argument, never once did a racial issue come up. Never once did anybody talk about black or white. They just were two people angry as hell at each other. And the next week, they made up. And they're playing tennis again. That's how things should be.
You tell a couple of good stories. In fact, there's one. I'm trying to remember the actor's name. You were invited to a country club, I believe, once by
yes,
a rather well-known name.
Lex Barker.
Oh, yeah, right. Just tell it briefly. People an example.
I have been someone who's gone through life, and sometimes people think they're paying me a compliment by saying, gee, you don't look Jewish. Whatever that means, I don't know what it means.
Right.
Because I've been in Israel and I've seen Jews who are redheads. I've seen them dark. And it's a funny thing. If they come from Morocco, they look Moroccans. You know, if they come from Yemen, they look like Yemenites. So somehow, I don't know what that means. But at this time, Lex Barker was taking me to this exclusive tennis club and he wanted me to become a member. And he said to me, well, of course, he says, you know, we can't have a club the way we have back east. We have to let some Jews in, you know, but you understand that. I said, yeah, I understand that. But, of course, I said, in a quiet way, I said, of course, Lex, being Jewish myself, I said, I feel rather differently. And there was a sudden thud. But those things don't bother me.
Kirk Douglas is our guest this morning. And, Boris, did you have a question or a comment?
I've sort of had a comment. I'm a little nervous because I've never been on the radio before.
Well, listen, it's just a conversation between a bunch of guys.
So far, Boris, you're doing great.
And the reason I'm calling is that my life really parallels Kirk Douglas's life.
In what way?
Well, I grew up being a ragman, a junk man's son. No communication with my father. Had to make it on my own because of my religion. And had a fight every minute of the day, and now I'm a very successful artist with a gallery in the North Shore and one in Florida. So it does work out, even though there wasn't any communication. And it did hurt for a while, but we do begin to understand. And I apologize for sounding nervous, but it's very difficult to speak about things like that, as I'm sure.
Oh, I'm sure. Oh, yeah, it's understandable.
Well, when I was writing my book, I went through a long process about that. But, you know, in writing my autobiography, I also feel my book is a tribute to this country, because when my parents came here from Russia...
And mine did too, by the way.
And things were rough. In comparison, they thought...
Oh, yeah.
You know, it was marvelous. After all, I did get a chance to work my way through college, go through dramatic school, and finally end up in the field that I wanted. So that if my parents missed that boat from Russia, I don't know what Issa Danilovich would have been doing now in Russia.
What, have you ever thought of what you would do if you were not an actor?
Oh, I don't know. I might have been a gangster. I don't know.
When did you decide?
Well, I think all actors, it's a form of escape. Obviously, in my case, being smothered by seven women, my father, who I wanted to identify rarely at home, and my father was an amazing man. Lots of times when I play in movies with Burt Lancaster or John Wayne and I'm in a saloon, I think of my father because that was his habitat. Hmm. He was a big drinker. He was probably the strongest man in the town. He was quite a physical guy, and I wanted to identify with him. Hmm. And he was always away, and I was stuck with my sisters and my mother. So that was a difficult upbringing. That's why when I finally got to college, it was like an escape. Once I went to college, I never came back home, maybe for a day or two to visit, but I never came back.
Boris, I appreciate you sharing a little bit of your story.
Well, I'd love to have Mr. Douglas's autograph book, but obviously I'm in the gallery and I just can't get downtown to get one. But,
well, he will be at Crocs at noon today for a couple of hours. Maybe you know a buddy in town who'll go over. Okay?
Well, maybe so, but I really do appreciate the time that I spent with you.
Thank you, Boris.
Thank you.
It's 14 before 11. Hi, Dale.
Good morning, Roy. Good morning, Mr. Douglas.
Good morning, Dale.
How are you today?
I'm just fine. The weather, they scared me about the weather when I was in L.A. a few days ago about how hot it is here, but it's just beautiful.
Stick
nice
around. It'll get hot again for you. I wanted to call to tell you how much I have enjoyed watching your movies, especially my two favorites, The Final Countdown and Tough Guys.
Thank you. Thank you.
Final Countdown is one of my favorites.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that because my son, Peter, brought that project to me, and he was the producer of Final Countdown. And Roy, he'll be here. You'll be talking to him.
I
He's
hope
quite
so.
A guy.
I'd like to meet him. Yeah.
Excellent movie. I mean, it just historically. You play a very good captain, Yellen, by the way.
Thank you. Of course, in movies, I usually am upgraded. In the Navy, I was an ensign and then a JG. I never got that high in life.
Oh, by the way, let me, a quick question before you continue, Dale. There is, the book has a number of great pictures in it. One of the interesting things was that it evidently the only... The one picture that's in this book that shows Kirk Douglas in the Navy is the only picture you could find.
That's right.
That's kind of surprised me. I would think you would have had a whole albums of photographs of everything you've ever done.
No. Well, you know, World War II, as a matter of fact, a lot of people are sort of surprised. They don't know anything about my war record because it was something that was not pleasant to me. I mean, war, I remember when I was there, a communications officer, there we were tracking down Japanese submarines, and I'm thinking we're trying to kill young Japs in a submarine. It wasn't a pleasant experience to me. I know some people look back with fond memories on it. I don't.
Mm. Okay. Anyway, something else, Dale.
Yes. I understand, Mr. Douglas, that you had made a comment during, I guess it was when you were presenting the Academy Award to your son, something about One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And I guess you wanted to play the role of...
Oh, this is a great story, by
McMurphy.
The way.
I really never heard the whole thing. If you would be so kind as to
well,
tell
of
it
course,
to me once again.
When you buy The Ragman Son, you're going to buy the book, aren't you? You're
yes,
not gonna,
I am.
That's good. No, I deal with that because it's a wonderful story. You see, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest was a book written by a young writer from Portland, Oregon.
Ken Kesey.
I bought the book. I thought it was a wonderful book. And I had it made into a play. I played the part on Broadway for almost 5-6 months.
Mm.
The audiences really responded to it. They were gripped by it. The critics hated it.
Mm.
So I got very bad reviews. Then for 10 years, I tried to make it into a movie. A very inexpensive movie. I never thought it would be a big successful picture, but I thought it was a wonderful story, and I was dying to do it and dying to play the part of McMurphy. After 10 years, my son Michael, who was doing The Streets of San Francisco, said, Dad, look, let's be partners. Let me take a chance to put it together. And he went outside the studio system, who had all turned it down. He got someone to put up the money, and they made the movie. But by that time, they thought, well, maybe Kirk's a little too old for that part. So all of a sudden, they did the movie with Jack Nicholson, who, of course, gave a brilliant performance and won an Oscar. The picture made over $200 million and won the most Oscars of any movie. And that shows you that with all the experts in Hollywood, there are not that many experts that know something, sometimes can escape something that's very good. And that's the story of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
I had to read that in college. It was part of one of the curriculums that I was taking for a literature course. And when you were saying that about playing the part, as what you did on Broadway, too, I can picture you, and for them saying that you're too old, they should have seen you in Tough Guys with your shirt off. You don't look too old to...
Yeah, I think, don't you think I'm... I think I'm ready... I think I was too young. I think I'm about ready to play it now.
You could do it now. They should have One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest again.
Well, we may make a reissue of that, and I'll play it.
Thanks,
all right.
Thanks,
Roy. Thank you, Mr. Douglas.
Thank
God bless you.
10 minutes before 11. Kirk Douglas will be over at Crocs and Brentano's on Wabash in about an hour or so, if you want to drop by. And it's about 8.5 minutes before 11 on WGN in Chicago. Kirk Douglas. I suppose if we talk about every single movie, we would need about 4 or 5 hours. But there are a couple of movies. I think Joe wants to talk about one. And there are some great stories in the book about this one, Joe.
Mr. Douglas? Mr. Douglas?
Yes, sir.
Welcome to Chicago.
Thank you.
Mr. Douglas, I don't want to reminisce about the past, but I personally felt terrible when you didn't win the Academy Award for Lust for Life.
How do you think he thought?
You were brilliant.
Well, there were two of us.
I'm so...
You know, let me tell you the story of that. When I'd been nominated, I never won an Oscar. I've been nominated about 3 times. And when I was nominated for Lust for Life, everyone had convinced me, it wasn't too difficult, that I was going to win the Oscar. And at that time, I think I was preparing The Vikings or Paths of Glory. I was in Germany. And I was at the Hotel Fürjahrzeiten, and there was about 50 reporters down in the lobby with their cameras all ready to come up into my room, burst into my room, and get the smile of victory as it was announced that I won the Academy Award. Of course, I didn't win, and Yul Brynner, who did a musical, got the Oscar,
right,
and everybody snuck away. But that same moment about a 30 seconds later, there was a knock on the door, and a package arrived, and I opened it, and it was an Oscar. My wife had gotten an Oscar, and she had inscribed on it, "With us, you always rate an Oscar," and it was signed,
wow,
my wife and my son, Peter. Eric wasn't born then. So I keep that, and I tell her if I ever win an Oscar, I'll give her my Oscar in return for the one she gave me.
Wow.
By the way, there are some great stories in the book about the making of that film, which must be, if it isn't your favorite, it's got to be one of those roles, Kirk, that
Well, Lust for Life, I don't know if I'd say it was my favorite. It was the most painful role that I played. It was the one that had the most devastating effect on me because his life was so poignant. It was so filled with rejections. And I identified so closely because he was about the same age when he committed suicide as I was when I was playing the role.
Yeah.
So I felt very... as a matter of fact, when the movie was made, I never looked at it. That's me hitting the mic. I never looked at it. It took me about 6 months before I ever watched the movie.
Had you been a student of art? Did you know about his paintings? And the...
Well, of course, I feel now when I look like out of Van Gogh that I painted it. And, of course, I've studied it, and there's a book of letters that he wrote to his brother Theo that are so comprehensive. They give you a complete picture of the man. And since then, especially with the help of my wife, who's quite knowledgeable in art, I have developed quite an interest in art, and we have a very interesting collection.
You mentioned wife, the mother of two of your sons.
That's right.
But the mother of your first two sons...
The mother of my first two sons is a girl from Bermuda called Diana, who's now married to a wonderful guy called Bill Derrick, and we still remain very good friends.
I know, you told me about that.
Our four sons sort of look at us because we always have dinner about once a month.
The four of you?
The four of us, yeah.
This is great.
And we, gossip about the boys and what a pain in the butt they are and this and that. And we have a wonderful relationship. And when I had the book party about a week ago in Los Angeles on The Ragman's Son, my ex-wife Diana was there with her husband. So we have a very good relationship, which is very important to me because when somebody has been an important part of your life, you've had two children with them, it would be terrible to have that just cut off and cut out. So we all get along, and my wife gets along very well with her, and we both all get along very well with the man that she married, Bill Derrick, who I feel very warm toward because he was a wonderful surrogate father when Michael and Joel were still growing up.
Oh, if everybody were as lucky, huh? Hi, Judy.
Hi. Welcome to the Midwest, I should say, because I'm calling from Dubuque, Iowa.
Wow.
Hi, Jenny.
We're happy to have you, and I'm excited about getting your book. It sounds really fascinating.
Thank you.
I was curious from a personal point of view of if whether you still have a relationship with your sisters.
Oh, of course. I mean, I have, of course, I now have four of my sisters are living. I had six sisters, and certainly I have, you know, my sisters were really wonderful girls. I did a TV program some time ago with Barbara Walters, and one of my sisters was on there, and I was quite surprised. She was so nervous. She told me, "Oh, I'm so nervous," and she handled herself very well. You see, I feel indebted to my six sisters because being the only man in the family, when I went off to college, they could easily have said, "Wait a minute, you're the only man in the family. Why don't you stay here and help support the family?" But they were very supportive in allowing me to work my way through college and giving me a chance to get out into the world and run away, in a sense. So I'm always been greatly indebted to my six sisters.
That's wonderful.
Judy, thank you for taking the time.
Yes, I wanted to mention that his friend Burt Lancaster was just in Dubuque a few weeks ago filming Shoeless Joe with Kevin Costner. And we enjoyed watching him work.
Oh, he's wonderful. Well,
he certainly is.
Of course, we've been friends for about 40 years. I just played golf with him about 2 weeks ago, so...
Well, I only hope that you can look as well as he does when I saw him up close.
Judy, he does. He's sitting within 3 feet of me. He does.
That's wonderful.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you. Bye.
I got a kick out of your relationship with other actors. One of the kind of interesting ones was your relationship with John Wayne, who, by the way, you insisted on calling John.
Yes. Well, I'm not good at calling, using people by nicknames. I don't know what they mean. And, you know, everybody called John Duke. And I once said to him, Duke, why not King? but John Wayne and I had a very interesting relationship. We didn't see eye to eye politically. When we made about four movies, usually on his initiative. I remember him calling me in London once saying, look, I've got a script, Kirk, called Cast a Giant Shadow. If you play the lead, I'll play the American General. And we, during the shooting of a picture, we'd have dinner once, and we'd argue a little bit, you know, throw digs at one another. But about a month ago, I was talking to a writer, Steve Shagan, who was a very good friend of Wayne, and he said to me, you know, John Wayne loved you. And I was shocked. He, what? He said, well, he just thought you were terrific. He called you, he said, a reflector. And what he meant by that, apparently, is that when we were acting together, I reflected things off of him. And, you know, it really made me feel quite emotional because, I mean, if I had known he had such a warm feeling, I think it would have changed so much of my attitude toward him because I thought, well, we got along. He liked doing movies with me, but I never knew that he had that warm feeling.
Did he, or maybe did you, ever try to upstage each other? I mean, here are a couple of big egos, you know.
Well, yes, I remember we were doing War Wagon and And I was playing this show-off cowboy who, every time he got on the horse, he got on a different way. Fancy, over the rump, side saddle, everything. So they were going to have a stuntman do it and then come in on a close-up. And I said, wait a minute, I think I can do all those mounts. And the stuntman looked at me and I said, look, just get me a little trampoline. Because I realized all you need to make a fancy mount is height. Yeah. You need to get yourself up there. And, of course, trampoline is tricky to operate, but if you know how to handle it. So I did all the mounts myself. So one day there was a newspaper man interviewing Wayne, and he said, I understand Kirk is really terrific with a horse. And he said, oh, terrific. He said, he can't even get on a horse without a trampoline.
Kirk Douglas has written his autobiography. It's called The Ragman Son. Simon & Schuster is the publisher. In fact, Kirk will be signing books over at Crocs and Brentano's in about an hour.